I'm Caleb Brown, host of the Cato Daily Podcast. It is December, and I'm once again here to ask you to support this podcast and the broad mission of the Cato Institute by becoming a podcast sponsor. If you support Cato to the tune of $1,000, I'll give you a shout-out on the podcast. The only way to do this is to visit cato.org/podcast sponsor and make your contribution. Cato accepts no government money, and we depend on the generosity of our sponsors to help us advance the values of individual liberty, limited government, free markets, and peace. Visit cato.org/podcast sponsor and support the Cato Daily Podcast and the Cato Institute. This is the Cato Daily Podcast for Friday, December 20th, 2019. I'm Caleb Brown. When a secretive federal court approved surveillance of a former Trump campaign official, the problems with the government's repeated applications for that surveillance set off an important discussion about just how well the Foreign Intelligence Surveillance Court, or FISC, functions. Cato's Julian Sanchez discusses the case and the structural problems that afflict that court. When the government asks for some sort of surveillance or asks for a special privilege from the FISA court, how well are those applications assembled and put together generally? Or do we have any way of knowing?
You know, in a hearing on Wednesday before the Senate Judiciary Committee on Justice Department Inspector General Michael Horowitz's new report on FISA and the Carter Page investigation, there was, I think, a really telling exchange between IG Horowitz and Senator Marsha Blackburn. She said, you know, let me ask you, how common is it to find mistakes like this in a FISA application? He had documented 17 different misrepresentations or omissions of varying degrees of seriousness to the FISA court in the application to do electronic surveillance on Carter Page, or rather the four applications to do surveillance on Carter Page. And I think she asked that question expecting the answer, well, it's incredibly rare, and this would demonstrate that something really egregious had happened in this particular instance. But Horowitz's answer, quite candidly, and perhaps to his credit, was, you know, he can't really say because this is the first time this very thorough probe of the process of getting a FISA on former Trump campaign advisor Carter Page, this was the first time they had done this sort of deep dive, that they had delved this thoroughly into an application to kind of kick the tires. And so he had to say, you know, I sort of hope that is quite unusual. And, you know, if not, that would suggest some kind of cultural problem. But I think that that ought to be very worrying, that you get a report like this that is extremely bad, I think, for the FBI, that certainly, with respect to the renewal applications, at least, documents some really inexcusable misrepresentations to the court, and in one case, actual alteration of a document to essentially falsify facts, and then to say, well, is that representative? How bad is this relative to a normal FISA on someone who is not a politically connected person in a case everyone recognizes is hugely politically sensitive and likely to be the subject of congressional hearings. And if the answer is, yeah, we just don't know if this is normal, that should send a little shiver down your spine.
Now, with respect to some of the orders that FISC has approved in the past, one of them was broad surveillance of records for virtually all Americans.
Yeah. So there are a bunch of problems with the Foreign Intelligence Surveillance Court, I think, structurally. So a normal warrant is issued, after an ex parte hearing. If you're going to do a search on someone or wiretap their phone, obviously that initial argument has to be secret because you don't get very good information if you announce publicly that you're going to wiretap someone. But it's always done with an eye toward, in the criminal case, eventual criminal prosecution. And even if you don't end up ultimately charging anyone on the basis of wiretap evidence. The target of wiretap surveillance, of what's called a Title III wiretap, that's the statutory authority for a criminal wiretap investigation, has to be informed about it after the surveillance end. So you have this kind of, you know, a couple of things. One, you have this sort of back-end process where when people are drafting that warrant, they know the point of this is to get evidence I can introduce in court, at which point the defendant's attorney is going to have is going to be entitled to discovery and disclosure of all sorts of exculpatory evidence, and that if we haven't properly represented the facts on the front end, there's a chance that whatever evidence we got is going to get thrown out of court and sort of invalidate all the work that went in on the front end. And also, of course, the courts that are hearing this sort of exist in the context of just sort of public deliberative process, where if they make a ruling on a Fourth Amendment question or on a statutory question involving wiretap law, that is, in a sense, part of a public conversation, both among judges, things get appealed and sent to a higher court, but also with legislators who might say that ruling is bad, and so if that's how they interpret the statute, we need to pass new legislation to correct it. There's a huge statute called ECPA, the Electronic Communications Privacy Act, that was essentially a response to Supreme Court rulings holding that email lacked constitutional protections. Fortunately, that seems to have been superseded by later developments. You also have sort of the community of law scholars. You might have a vigorous debate in, among other lawyers, among the legal academy, saying, if you, dig into the history, this interpretation of the original public meaning of this constitutional phrase is not what the court thought. It's embedded in this larger process of sort of legal evolution. And so the FISA court has, all I think is a function of the fact that FISA surveillance is normally permanently covert. The public has never seen a FISA application until Carter Page's case. And that one we've only seen in a fairly heavily redacted form. There's never been anything remotely public like this kind of intensive investigation of a particular FISA process. And so the result of that secrecy on the one end, I think, is that the incentives facing the people sort of developing the investigation are a little bit skewed, and there's an additional point I would make on that in a second, and also that the FISC, as we now realize, because of the bulk call records collection disclosed by Edward Snowden originally, developed in effect its own sort of secret common law, if that's not a complete oxymoron, and so. When they agreed to approve this sort of essentially indiscriminate collection of Americans' call records on the theory that all of these were somehow relevant to an investigation, that was based on a previous decision involving internet metadata from a couple of years earlier, which presumably was based on decisions prior to that. And one of the things that's clear if you look at, again, the sort of unprecedented fact that we now have quite a lot of published FISA court opinions, it's clear that, one, they're operating in their own sort of self-contained environment of making rulings and setting precedent based exclusively on arguments from the government. So over time, that tends to accrete a body of, kind of very specific case law for one court that's, again, based on essentially the government getting its way and deciding what cases to appeal.
So combine the fact that the one FISA application that we know the most about has significant problems in the way that the government presented its case, combined with the generally secret nature of the FISC itself, and the fact that they are largely separate from adversarial law as it's practiced everywhere else in the United States, and without giving up the government's ability to engage in completely legitimate surveillance in order to protect Americans. What's the fix there? Because you don't necessarily want the public to have broad access to all of these opinions. You don't necessarily want to hamper certain law enforcement investigations. But at the same time, there has to be a process by which these applications are vetted in a better way than the even highly vetted application that we saw that had such significant problems.
Yeah, I mean, so one thing I think to focus on is, so before an application even reaches the court, there is what is, in as far as it goes, a somewhat rigorous process known as the Woods procedure. So these were implemented in the early 2000s after the FISA court discovered that several of the applications submitted to it had contained fairly serious misrepresentations. They ended up essentially barring the FBI agent who had been the affiant on those applications from essentially submitting anything to the FISA court, which will basically end your career if you're working on that sort of stuff, intelligence matters. And so the Woods procedures were designed to verify that the information in application to the FISA court all matches some document in the FBI's underlying case file. So if you say, this is what we got on a transcript or what someone said to a confidential informant, do you actually have notes or a transcript from the interview that validates that's what was said? And there were some failures of the Wood procedures that Horowitz identified here, some cases where, statements were made that weren't properly documented or the claim in the application was somewhat different from what was in the case file. But most of those were not really very serious issues. How much money was Christopher Steele paid? There wasn't documentation of that dollar figure. A lot of it was stuff that's not very important. The serious issues, and they're mostly not with the initial application, but with the renewal applications as the case developed. The initial stages, they essentially didn't have a lot of information. And it's worth noting a lot of the things that, in terms of the sort of public and media discussion, people think are were kind of outrageous or symptoms of abuse are not things Horowitz really took issue with. Those are just normal for FISA. So the fact that a significant part of this application was based on a sort of single source, this notorious Steele dossier that was based on kind of secondhand information, and that Steele himself had been hired to do opposition research, which might have suggested a bias. All of that, Horowitz acknowledges, is just normal for FISA. By FISA standards, that is not, the problem as the IG at least sees it. That's not a rules violation. That's just how FISA works normally. The problem is that as they continued investigating and turning up less limited information and finding that some of it contradicted representations they'd originally made, they essentially did not take account of those things and go back and amend their initial representations to say, actually, for example, one of Steele's subsources gave a somewhat different account from what was in the Steele dossier. And some of the claims that he passed on to Steele, he himself regarded as sort of gossip or jokes. And the problem is that the Woods procedures are not well designed to catch things that are left out of the application as opposed to inaccurate claims that do make it into the application. You cannot fact check a fact that does not make it in.
And that's part of just the fact that this is not an adversarial process?
That's part of, I mean, of course, that again is true of any wiretap or warrant application. Yeah. Though, again, I think it probably has some effect that there is an expectation on the criminal side, not that there aren't, bad search warrants on the criminal side that are drafted, but there is at least an expectation that if you have gotten this under false pretenses, that may come back to bite you when this information is presented in public, in a public legal proceeding. I think one of the things that's clear we absolutely need to do is this kind of deep dive audit on a sort of random sample of of FISA applications for a couple of reasons. One, we want to know how common problems like this are. Is this some sort of outlier case, or is this just sort of a normal distribution of misrepresentations and omissions? But also in part because I think that may be one of the ways of ameliorating the problems we find. That is to say, to the extent that one of the issues here is nobody really expects the tires to be kicked. That, you know, if you've said something in the initial application and it turns out that's not quite right, well, you know, who's going to know if you don't decide to tell the FISA court? And so the prospect of sort of random deep dive audits might encourage a little bit more care in looking for kind of potentially exculpatory facts. I think, you know, one of the factors here, I think, may also be, even talking about exculpatory facts is kind of borrowing language from sort of criminal procedure. And it's important to stress, I think this may be a factor in why the renewal applications in particular ended up getting sort of progressively worse. Is there's an important difference between FISA wiretaps and criminal Title III wiretaps. So when you get a criminal wiretap, there is the purpose of the surveillance, and there's the showing you have to make to a court. And under Title III, those two are pretty tightly aligned, right? The purpose of a Title III wiretap is to gather evidence of a crime, ideally that you can introduce in court as part of a criminal prosecution. And then the showing you have to make to a court is probable cause to believe that this surveillance will uncover evidence of a crime that is or has or is about to occur. So the criteria for whether this wiretap was successful is basically the same as the criteria for justifying it in the first instance. And so if you do an initial, let's say, 30 days or 60 days of a wiretap, and then you're saying, was it successful? The evidence that you get that is say if you find evidence of a crime that is both justification for the thing being successful, evidence that has fulfilled its purpose, and also what you would need to show a court to say this is justified to continue this surveillance. And under FISA, those two things, the purpose and the showing, kind of come apart. Because the purpose of FISA surveillance is to gather foreign intelligence information, which is very broadly defined, whereas the showing to the court is that in the case of a U.S. person, that they are an agent of a foreign power, meaning, again, this is a definition specific to U.S. persons, that they are knowingly, it's a complicated definition, but the core one here is they're knowingly engaged in clandestine intelligence activities at the behest of a foreign power. And the thing is, foreign intelligence information is a fairly broad category, so that, you know, a lot of people who are not knowingly engaged in clandestine intelligence activities might well frequently have phone conversations that contain foreign intelligence information, right? If you have a businessman who has contact with foreign, foreign people in business or foreign government officials, those conversations might very well have elements that qualify as foreign intelligence information without that, the U.S. person end being a foreign agent. And I think that disconnect may, play in here, because if you are not looking, right, with an eye toward prosecution, but with an eye of a sort of counterintelligence person, and you're saying, has this surveillance been productive? Has it fulfilled its purpose? You might look and say, yes, we got some things here that are foreign intelligence and that may be valuable to the government in various ways. But unlike the Title III case, the criminal investigative case, answering yes to that question, right, does not necessarily validate the initial premise that, yes, the target of the surveillance was a foreign agent. So I think, again, maybe especially if you have folks who have a background working Title III cases, that may be a source of kind of not quite seeing that you haven't validated the initial showing. Because after the court has once accepted, okay, you've cleared the bar for a probable cause to say this targets an agent of a foreign power, I think probably the focus shifts somewhat to, all right, what foreign intelligence information are we getting? And it can, you know, maybe easy to then sort of neglect that you may be getting that without actually bolstering your original representation. And indeed, if you look at what officials involved in reviewing those renewal applications told IG Horowitz, you know, one of the things they say is, yeah, you know, when we looked at the renewal applications, when we did the vetting for those applications, all the new stuff, the new claims that were added were in bold. You know, sort of like track changes for a legal submission. And so the vetting process then focused on those new claims. And the obvious problem there is if that's what you're focusing on, you're not going back and saying, you know, and in some cases, you know, they would have had to go trawling through the case file to find perhaps the elements that conflicted.
It's not a review.
Right. But in other cases, you know, it might have been more clear based on even just sort of things in the newspapers that some of those initial representations were wrong. But they're not sort of going back to stuff the court has already accepted and saying, well, this is what we said in September or October, but now, you know, 6 months later, do those claims still hold up? Can we still, you know, honestly say this is our best assessment of what the facts are?
Julian Sanchez is a senior fellow at the Cato Institute. You can support the Cato Institute and the Cato Daily Podcast with an end-of-the-year gift. Visit cato.org/podcast sponsor, and thank you.